Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 29th of March. Our guest this hour, who is a professor emeritus of Italian at the University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and directed the honors program there for a number of years, says that he was giving a speech at the Freshman Honors Society, and one of the students said to him, after the speech, you've had a great life, Italian food and baseball. And without knowing it, that young man had summarized in a nutshell the genesis of Larry Baldassarro's book, which is what we talk about with Larry this hour, Beyond DiMaggio, Italian Americans in Baseball. Larry is the grandson of four Italian immigrants and has been passionate about baseball as long as he can remember. He began writing about the game almost 30 years ago, and he says there was a time when I could not have imagined writing about Italian-American ballplayers. He has written a lot of books, actually, a lot of baseball books. His previous books include the Ted Williams Reader, The American Game, Baseball and Ethnicity, and Ted Williams Reflections on a Splendid Life. I like that word, splendid life. And Larry also is a ballplayer. I don't know if he plays ball at all now or not. We'll ask him that. But he was a really good pitcher when he was in high school, and he played American Legion and semi-pro as a pitcher. His high school and Legion teams, you got to bring this up when you can, won the state title in 1960. He also was an invited speaker at the Hall of Fame celebration of Italian Americans in baseball in 2006. He was invited by Major League Baseball to serve as the interpreter for Team Italy at the inaugural World Baseball Classic. And he is with us in our studios today. Hi, Larry.
Hi. Nice to be here.
You do have this wonderful combination of Italian, baseball. Larry's a friend of mine. I must tell you this, too. So we've been out to eat at great Italian restaurants. It all kind of weaves together. But you're a baseball guy, too, and the head of the honors program. So it all just worked out for you, didn't it, Larry? It's been a splendid life.
I can't complain.
I bet you can't complain. And just personally, talk about where this fascination with baseball, where did it come from? Was it when you were in high school and you became really good at it and learned the game, or was it before that because of the Italian background?
Well, I don't think it had anything to do with the Italian background. It had to do with growing up American, as they say. I can't remember anything that sparked it. It was just something that was in there. But, you know, when I was a kid in the post-war years, everybody played baseball. I mean, that was the American game, mm-hmm. still, without question. But for some reason, I mean, I played basketball and my friends on the street. We'd put a hoop up on the telephone pole. We'd play touch or even tackle football on the fields nearby. I mean, we grew up in a great area. But baseball was a sport that just really grabbed me. I mean, when I first started, a neighbor who was a coach of what we call the Pee Wee League team, 8 to 10 years old, he saw me throwing the ball off the stoop of the side of the house one day. He'd walk back and forth, and one day he stopped and says, "Hey, would you like to play on a team?" I said, "Sure." It was a Nativity Church team. And I still remember the first practice, probably in April. Had to walk across. The field was at the backside of a park, just a half mile from my house. And I'll never forget, 10 years old, walking across that field toward the diamond for my first organized practice, the aroma of the grass fresh today as it was way back then.
Oh, and there are all those associations with that game. And it is baseball. It's not other sports. It's baseball. It's renewal. It's spring.
Yes.
It's our fathers and our grandfathers and our great and our grandparents who came, yes, from other places to this country. It takes it all in somehow, doesn't,
mm-hmm,
it?
It does, and it really connects the generations more than any other sport because of the continuity, and I think that whole notion about spring and renewal has something to do with it. It's, I suppose, one of the many reasons why it appeals more than any other sport to writers.
Right. There are a lot, and I was somewhere this came into my mind this week. There are a lot. Oh, it's from Michael, my husband, who was doing a TV show talking about the number of people who are interested in baseball are also readers, that baseball people tend to be readers. You hope, I'm sure,
that's the case.
And they'll get your book. But do you think that's true?
Oh, I think absolutely. Yeah. It's a game that allows for more time for reflection, even as you're watching it,
Right. Talking
about it. So I think all that reflection sort of lends itself to having the kind of mind that likes to read as well.
Mm-hmm. Italians in baseball, they came to the sport in great numbers when? At the end of the 1800s? At the beginning of the 1900s?
No, in great numbers, not until the 1930s. They first entered it right at the turn of the century. The man that I can identify as the first started in 1897. But you know, he was the exception that proved the rule. There were very few up until even the 20s. And then a few more in the 20s. But it wasn't until the 1930s that they actually entered in fairly large numbers.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of them seem to either come from San Francisco or play for the New York Yankees. Am I wrong about that?
No. With almost no exceptions, the early significant players, the ones that became well known, came from the San Francisco Bay Area. And, you know, everybody associates Italian ball players with New York City because they played for the Yankees, the Dodgers, the Giants, etc. But San Francisco was such a hotbed of amateur baseball, and it had a very large Italian population, that the two things came together, and that's the only plausible reason why so many of the early Italian ballplayers, even into the 40s, came from San Francisco, and most of them played in New York. Tony Lazzari, Frank Cossetti, the DiMaggios, Dolph Camilli, Ernie Lombardi. Yeah, it was a great phenomenon. The baseball was just so big in the San Francisco area. There are diamonds everywhere. Even though it was a city, it didn't have as much of an urban feeling, say, as New York did or Philadelphia, where there weren't as many diamonds to play on.
Were people in San Francisco more welcoming to Italians than people on the East Coast were?
They were. The Italians still, you know, they came in mainly as fishermen, so they weren't real high on the socioeconomic ladder. But because San Francisco or California in general was more open to these people, they were able to move up the socioeconomic ladder so that you got people like, of course, Ghirardelli, you know, the chocolate millionaire.
Oh, I know it well, eh?
Yes. And Giannini, who founded the Bank of Italy, which then became the Bank of America. And, I mean, he helped produce Hollywood movies, provided funding for building the Golden Gate Bridge and so forth. So San Francisco really did provide opportunities that most of the large eastern cities didn't provide for Italians.
I was struck by, and which is one of the reasons you write a book about this, but I was struck by the kind of discrimination that Italians faced. I guess I didn't realize that their pay was much lower and was advertised as such. If you were Italian, your pay was way, way down there. And the names that were associated with Italians during the end of the 1800s and into the many years in the 1900s, it was pretty fierce, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, a lot of it was verbal. You know, the ethnic slurs that were hurled at them, Dago, Wop, Guinea. But at times, the verbal violence turned into physical violence. I think it's estimated there were something like 55 Italians that were lynched in states from New York to Mississippi in those early years. And in 1891, the biggest mass lynching in American history took place in New Orleans when 11 Italian-Americans, many of whom had been on trial for the killing of a local police chief, were acquitted, and yet the mob broke them out of jail and killed 11 of them.
And was it seems as though all of the immigrant groups faced their own form of discrimination. Was there something particularly bad about what the Italians faced, do you think? And if so, why that might be the case?
Well, I think the main reason is that they were the largest number. Of all the immigrant groups that came between the 1880s and 1920, Italians were by far the most numerous. I think another reason is they were more identifiable by their names. I mean, the Slavs that came, some of their names, they may not look so American, but you couldn't tell if they were Polish or Hungarian. The Italian names were pretty unmistakable. And from early on, from the 1880s on, if you read the New York Times, Italians are portrayed either as, you know, the fruit peddlers, the organ grinders, or those who are prone to pull out a knife and get into fights and so prone to violence. And then inevitably, the organized crime, the mafia tag, got stuck on them very early on. And that one still hasn't gone away.
Yeah. Let's talk about the DiMaggio's for a moment. I didn't realize there were three brothers in that family that played Major League Baseball. And the preface is written by Don DiMaggio, who passed away shortly after he wrote the preface to your book. How did that happen? Three Major League ballplayers in one family?
In one immigrant family. I mean, it was sort of the American dream come to life. Giuseppe DiMaggio had come from a small town in Sicily. His father and his father before him had been fishermen. So he came to California, a town just north of San Francisco, and became a fisherman, of course. They had five sons and four daughters.
Of course,
Giuseppe, being old world, assumed that his sons would follow him in the fishing business. The mentality that they brought with him is that, you know, you were born to do something, and that's what you did. Because in the old world, and this is why they left, there really were very few opportunities, if any, to change, to make your life better. They grew up in this agrarian or fishing economy that remained stagnant for a long, long time. And they also brought that distrust of outsiders because of all the foreign invasions that had come through southern Italy and Sicily over the centuries. So Giuseppe just had that mindset. This is how it is. This is how it will be. And the two oldest sons did go into the fishing business with him. But the third son, Vince, who was older than Joe, he wanted to be an opera singer. And there was even thought of sending him to Italy to study music and singing. But he also liked baseball. So he became a professional baseball player. But his father wouldn't sign, because he was underage, his father wouldn't sign the contract. So Vince just left home and went somewhere, I think, in Utah or somewhere, to play professional baseball in the minor leagues. So he spent the summer doing that, and he earned something like $1,500, which was a lot of money in those days, in the early 30s, during the Depression. So at the end of the summer, he came home and put the cash on the table in front of Giuseppe, and that changed everything.
Oh, maybe I have some other sons who can play this game.
Dom DiMaggio, when I met him here during the All-Star festivities in 2002, he said, you know, after that, my father turned to me and said, and when are you going to start playing baseball? And that was true of a lot of these early players whose parents objected. They said, well, you can't make a living playing this child's game. They had no conception of what baseball was. It was a waste of time. When you had a son, when he got to be a certain age, you expected him to go to work, help support the family. But when these guys did start playing professional baseball and brought home the paycheck, then the parents suddenly realized, oh, you can make a living doing this.
And what about Joe? Was he the best baseball player who ever lived, Larry?
No, even I couldn't go that far. In fact, I never would have, because I was a Red Sox fan. I love Ted Williams. But the greatest that ever lived, no. But the greatest of his era, I think without question. Everybody who played with him and against him, including Ted Williams, who was his arch rival, always said, I thought I was a better hitter than Joe, but Joe was the best all-around player I ever saw. And that was his reputation. Yeah. He did everything well. He did it well, and he made it look easy. That was the other thing. He was so graceful and effortless in what he did.
And hit in so many consecutive games.
Well, in 1941, he hit in 56 straight games, which many people think is, you know, the greatest baseball record that will never be broken, and an incredible sporting feat beyond all statistical possibility.
And took care of the funeral arrangements, is that right, for Marilyn Monroe,
mm-hmm.
his wife?
Yes, well, of course, they were only married for 9 months, but he clearly remained devoted to her. And this, again, his brother Dom told me, he said he was devoted to her for the rest of his life. There was some idea that they were going to get back together.
Really?
They were dating again, and this was just before she died.
Aww.
So he stepped in, and he blamed the Hollywood people for her death, not to mention some Washington people. And he refused to let any of them come to the funeral. He took charge, and very few people other than close friends were allowed to come to the funeral. And then, of course, he ordered that roses be placed at her grave twice a week in perpetuity.
There is something about this story, isn't it, that this guy who comes from the background that you just described winds up being this phenomenal ball player and is known forever. He's been gone for a while, and we're talking about him, and people mm-hmm. will talk about him. And he marries Marilyn Monroe, this mm-hmm. icon of, and her career takes off, and we remember her forever. It's really quite a remarkable story, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the great American love story that, of course, was doomed from the start, because Joe, he had been married before, and he'd married an actress, a showgirl. So, but he expected Marilyn Monroe to become a housewife. I mean, that's really what he wanted. And of course, that was not going to happen.
Yeah.
So, unfortunately, the marriage itself only lasted those 9 months, but clearly his affection for her never died. And yeah, it's a tremendous story. The prince and princess of 20th century America, in a sense. I mean, the greatest star of his era and the greatest film star coming together. Yeah, it was a made in Hollywood, but also broken by Hollywood because the famous story of when she was filming The Seven-Year Itch and that scene when they're in New York City with the air from the subway vent blowing up her skirt. And he was watching the filming of that. And that sort of was the last straw.
Hmm. What was it about, without overstating this, but maybe you can't overstate it, to have somebody like that make it as big as he did, to be that graceful an athlete and that good an athlete, and to be an Italian-American with his background, what did it do for bringing Italian-Americans to baseball, for more players, just for a sense of we've arrived, we've made it,
right,
and we're more accepted now than we used to be? Am I overstating that?
Not at all. Not at all. One of the points I make in the book is these early Italian ball players. In fact, one who played 10 years before Joe, Tony Lazzeri, who was the first major star, again, from San Francisco, and Italian fans would come into the stadium waving flags, and they'd have banquets in all the cities where the Yankees would play to honor him. But it was too early for him to be a national hero. The anti-immigrant sentiment was still too strong in the mid-20s. DiMaggio comes along in 36 and immediately becomes a successor to Babe Ruth, leads them to a World Series in his rookie year, and is immediately recognized as the leader of the team and the best player in baseball. So, again, the fans are coming, waving flags. It clearly gave them a great sense of identity because of all the discrimination they had faced, the ethnic stereotypes for all those decades since the 1880s. And suddenly here you have the greatest star in the most important sport in America, one of your own. Clearly, it gave them a greater sense of pride than anybody had done. And I maintain in the book that these early ball players, particularly Lazzeri and DiMaggio, did more than anyone else before them to counter the public hostility and the demeaning stereotypes of Italians.
Hmm.
I don't think you can overstate the impact they had, both on raising the level of pride of Italians, but also changing the public perception of Italians to see them as something other than, you know, mafiosi and fruit peddlers and so forth.
And would it be going too far to say that it has done the same for subsequent groups, for African Americans, for Hispanic players, for Japanese players in this sport?
Without question. I remember when Pedro Martinez was still pitching for the Red Sox, and I was at a game at Fenway. He was pitching that day, and this is like a flashback to the days of Lazzeri and DiMaggio. Here are Dominican fans walking through the stands with big flags. I mean, clearly it was raising their sense of pride, and it gives you a sense of, you know, if this guy can make it, maybe there's hope for me. that maybe this American dream can be realized. I think
so why do we see that play out in baseball and we don't see it play out in football or in other sports? It's baseball that does that. Why?
I can only say it's, again, the whole issue that we discussed earlier. That it's such an American institution. It's a social institution unlike any other sport that we have because of the history going back to the middle of the 19th century, being the American game, being touted in the early 20th century as the game that can teach immigrants and their children how to be American. Mm. And I can give you a quick example from my own family of how that worked. My grandmother, who I grew up with, and in fact, she and my grandfather built the home that I grew up in. My parents got married in the Depression. My father moved in temporarily in the house, and 57 years later was still in that same house. So it was my grandparents' home. But my grandmother had two brothers who came over from Italy in their teens. And they were similar in some ways. One was called Enrico, which is the equivalent of Henry in English, but everybody outside the family called him Andy for no apparent reason. And his brother was Nuncio, who everybody called Charlie.
Of course.
Yeah, that was very common. Well, they both worked as hod carriers in the construction company. Neither one ever married. So they were similar in that way. But the one thing that really separated them, Charlie Nuncio never felt at home in America. He didn't learn English really well. He lived in a small apartment. You could tell he just never adapted to American life. Andy, on the other hand, not only was he a hod carrier, but he worked part-time as a bartender. And his passport to acceptability with his customers and his coworkers was one thing. He was a baseball fan. He loved the Yankees. He could talk about the Yankees. He could talk about baseball. He was knowledgeable. I'd argue with him all the time because I was a Red Sox fan. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure he was a Yankee fan because they had all the Italian ballplayers and they were winning. But that, again, baseball was the thing that linked him to America. Ralph Fasanella, who's a famous primitive painter, born in 1914 in New York City to immigrant parents. And he said, this is what baseball meant to immigrants and their children. He said, we were the foreigners. We were the Ginzos from the other side of the tracks. Baseball was the only thing that brought it together. Baseball was America.
Yeah. We'll take phone calls for Larry in a moment. Larry Baldassaro is our guest, and his book is Beyond DiMaggio, Italian Americans in Baseball. We should tell you that he's going to be tomorrow at Boswell Books. Oh, it's Thursday. I'm sorry. What is today? Tuesday. I'm sorry. I forget what day it is. I'm getting up there. Thursday, March 31st at 7 p.m. at Boswell Books, and that's on Donner Avenue, 2559. He'll be talking about this more and signing his books at one of our favorite places. Daniel is our guest frequently, talking about books. We'll welcome phone calls. Here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Larry. 800-486-8655 is our number. Scott in La Crosse is our first caller. Hello, Scott. Hey, Scott, how are you?
I'm doing great.
Good.
Really enjoying this program.
Good.
I wanted to really call in and talk about the Pacific Coast League a little bit, but when you were talking about DiMaggio and Monroe, this story, I probably have the details wrong a little bit, but while they were married, I read they took a tour to Japan. And, you know, he was doing some baseball outings there. And while they were there, the Army asked Marilyn Monroe if she would go as a morale builder over to Korea to address the troops and, you know, just say hi and everything. So, you know, DiMaggio wasn't that wild about that, but she made the trip over there. And she came back just totally on a riding on a cloud, because, you know, she'd gotten up on stage before these thousands of GIs, and they were all going crazy, cheering for her. She comes back and she says, "Joe, it was just great. Me in front of all those people, they were all just cheering for me. You have no idea." And he goes, "Yes, I do." But what I called to talk about was, I grew up in California. I was born in the Bay Area, and went to school with a lot of Italian kids. And in those days, in the 1950s, baseball was almost entirely a Midwest and Northeast state. The furthest south, that went, no team further than the Mason-Dixon line south, and nobody west of St. Louis. And the Pacific Coast League, as I understand it, was a real going concern. And this is also so long ago that baseball players actually had to have jobs, most of them, in the off season to make ends meet. I mean, they were not getting fabulously paid, even at the major league level. And the Pacific Coast League did very well, paid their players very well. And as the professors mentioned, a lot of, you know, great Italian ball players came out of that system or that area. But my understanding is, and I would like to ask if he can confirm this, that a lot of these guys, or some of these guys, turned down the offer to go to the majors because they had a good life in on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. They would not make that much more money, and they had a nice job in a nice league that was very comfortable, and there were, you know, these, I mean, I grew up with teams like the Sacramento Solons and the Oakland Oaks and the San Francisco Seals. It was, you know, I mean, for us, it was baseball. We knew it until the Giants and the Dodgers moved west at the end of the 50s.
Hmm. Larry.
There's no doubt that the Pacific Coast League was the major league for the West Coast. And I couldn't give you any numbers, but I do know that there were a fair number of players who chose to remain in the Pacific Coast League rather than go east to play in the majors, just for the very reason that you stated, that they could make as much money, perhaps more, sometimes, and they just enjoyed living on the West Coast. In addition to that, a lot of the major leaguers who did play in the major leagues in, say, the 30s and 40s, when their careers in the majors ended, they went back and played for several more years in the Pacific Coast League and had some
really
great careers there.
Huh. Thank you, Scott, for the call. Al is next from Land O'Lakes. Hi, Al.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for the show. This is very great. It's timely, too, with the Barry Bonds trial going on. Anyway, back in 1973, I was standing bar at Eugene's Milwaukee, and I got to meet Joe Garagiola.
Ah.
And I was wondering if you could talk about him and Yogi Berra, who came from the Hill in St. Louis. And to me, Yogi Berra is like the greatest. I think he was in 10 World Series as a coach and a player. But I'd be interested in hearing you talk about him, and I'll get off and listen.
All right, Al, thanks very much for the call. They were friends, right?
Oh, they were best friends. They literally grew up across from each other in a street in St. Louis, which has now been renamed Hall of Fame Way because of the two of them. And the irony is that Joe Garagiola was signed first to play professional baseball. Branch Rickey thought that he was a better player than Yogi Berra as a youngster. So when the Yankees offered Yogi a certain amount to sign, it was less than Joe Garagiola had gotten, so Yogi refused. And it wasn't until later that they came around and offered him as much money, and then he would agree to sign. But, yeah, they were best friends. I think they still are. And, yeah, they grew up playing ball in the Hill section of St. Louis. And Yogi clearly went on to become, if not the best catcher, certainly one of the greatest catchers in baseball history. Garagiola had less of a great career as a player, but then he went on to a fabulous career as a broadcaster.
Right.
And he won a Peabody Award, and he won the award for broadcasters that puts you into the Hall of Fame exhibit for broadcasters. So It's an interesting combination. And, of course, many of the so-called yogi-isms have really been attributed to Joe Garagiola, who would come up with them on the air, and then they'd get attributed to Yogi. So Yogi says, I didn't say half the things I said.
So they kind of helped each other out.
That's
because
right.
Of Joe's position in broadcasting, he could use some of those phrases. So who actually gave you the quote that's on the back here? Was it Joe or Yogi?
Oh, no, that's Yogi.
That is Yogi.
Yes, can I read that?
Yeah, because it's very funny. It's great.
Classic Yogi.
Right.
Yeah, he writes, people used to say the Yankees won a lot because we led the league in Italians. All I'll say is there's a real good history of Italians in baseball, and this book has excellent history. Thank you, Yogi.
That's great. Couldn't ask for more than that, could you?
No.
Tony is next from Fond du Lac. Hi, Tony.
Hi, good morning, Larry. I can't wait to read the book. I have a two-part question.
Yes.
I grew up a fan of Ron Santo, but I identified more with him because I was a short, fat kid rather than an Italian-American kid. And I'm wondering if you think that lack of ethnic identity was because by that time, and this would be the 60s and 70s, there were really ethnic neighborhoods and that kind of identifying geography, if you will. And also, do you think that with his death recently, this will finally put Ron Santo in the Hall of Fame?
Well, I'll answer the second first. I don't know. I mean, there are certainly a lot of people who believe he should be in the Hall of Fame, and not many things in baseball can generate such vitriolic debates as who should or shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame. Personally, I think if you look at his statistics, they measure up pretty well with those other third basemen, and there aren't many third basemen in the Hall of Fame, fewer than in any other position. So I think an argument can be made whether or not his death is going to, you know, be the last thing to push him over the edge. I'm not really sure. But your first question about ethnic identity, is no question that after World War II, the ethnic identity of Europeans greatly diminished. That was in part because they served in World War II. They got to know other ethnic groups, so they were less, you know, sense of isolation. I think it was true among all European ethnics. And then, of course, after the war, they had greater chance for social and economic mobility because of the GI Bill and the growing economy. And they started to move away from the ethnic enclaves of the big cities into the suburbs. Regarding the Italians, for example, the late historian Rudolf Vickley at the University of Minnesota said that the 50s marked the end of the first phase of the history of Italians in America. He says the old immigrants were dying and their children were heading to the suburbs, hell-bent on becoming 100% American. So I think those are the factors, plus a lot of intermarriage. And when I interviewed people for my book, as I got into players from the 70s, 80s up to today, clearly their sense of ethnic identity, for the most part, was not nearly as clear and as strong as it had been for those guys who played before World War II.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Tony, for your call. Jim in Oshkosh, hi.
Hi. You had alluded to the fact that baseball is really our sport, and it certainly is, because I sit at Lambeau Field, and people say, did you see that crackback block? And I didn't even see the ball. Baseball is a game I can understand and I relate to. But I really wanted to say that back in the 50s, 1950, I was at the old Yankee Stadium, and it was either Vic Rashi or Allie Reynolds pitching, and Joe DiMaggio came up to bat in that beautiful wide stance, and he stroked hits all over the place, but the game went 10 innings, and I'm sure you will know who came in and got the pinch hit signal. That would be a reliable fellow, and that was Tommy Henrik. Mm-hmm. And I just have to say that that was quite an experience.
Well, I hope the pitcher was Vic Rashi, because he's from a town next to the city that I grew up in.
Oh, really?
Springfield, Massachusetts. His nickname was the Springfield Rifle. And he was, you know, the Yankees had three great pitchers there at the end of the 40s, early 50s, and Rashi won 21 games 3 years in a row starting in 49. So I'm hoping that you saw Rashi. But the one thing you said, too, about DiMaggio with his beautiful wide stance, I mean, that's what we were talking about before. It wasn't just the fact that he put up these statistics, but just how he looked, even standing at the plate, you know, this wide stance, very still. And then there's a classic painting of his follow-through called The Wide Swing. Nobody else had quite as dramatic a follow-through in his swing, perfectly balanced. And then, of course, he ran the bases better than anyone. Jimmy Breslin, the famous sports writer, once wrote that baseball isn't statistics. Baseball is Joe DiMaggio rounding second base.
Oh, that's nice. That's a nice quote to remember. Yeah. Let's talk about Bart Giamatti for a moment, because he's an Italian guy who was president of Yale. He becomes commissioner of baseball, which is unusual. Tell me about his background and what your thoughts are about this guy, who many have said was just absolutely brilliant, died way too young, and was great for the game.
Well, I have to confess to even a sort of a personal affinity for Bart Giamatti, because his father was a professor. His grandfather was an Italian immigrant, worked at the Yale Clock Company in New Haven. But his son, Bart's father, got a PhD at Yale and became a professor of Italian.
Oh, my.
So he taught at Mount Holyoke College in South Hadley, Mass. And I grew up in Chicopee, which is 3 miles away. And, of course, then when I got to know who he was later on, I really followed his career. And he gets a PhD and becomes a well-known scholar and then president of Yale at the age of 40, the youngest ever, and the first ethnic president of Yale. They made a big deal out of that. But, you know, he was A. Bartlett Giamatti, and the A stood for Angelo. He was named for his two grandfathers, his Italian grandfather Angelo, and Bartlett, his mother's family, was pure New England Yankee. She was descended from sea captains and shoe manufacturers. So there was that sort of ambiguity about his ethnic identity. So rather than being Angelo Giamatti, he was A. Bartlett. So it was a big deal then when he becomes president of Yale because of his ethnic background. And here he is at the highest levels of academe, and yet in 1986 when they say, "How'd you like to be president of the National League of Baseball?" He jumped at the opportunity. I mean, because that was his real love. And he said, well, why would they choose someone who was an academic to be president of the National League and then commissioner of baseball? It was because of what he had written about baseball. Mm. Giamatti, I think, was probably the most passionate and articulate spokesman the game has ever had. He
really
wrote beautifully about baseball, but baseball and the American experience, for him, they were one and the same. Mm. Baseball was a metaphor of American life. And that's what got him into baseball. And as you said, sadly, he died 5 months of the day after he became commissioner at the age of 51. But some people thought that he would have been a great commissioner because just of what he had done in that short time.
Mm. Well, he left a son who's a great actor.
Yes.
Yeah. Thanks, Jim, for your call. We have some lines open if you'd like to join the conversation. 800-486-8655. Larry Baldassaro is our guest, and his book is Beyond DiMaggio, Italian Americans in Baseball. Stephen from Downsville is our next caller. Hi, Stephen.
Yeah, I'm a huge baseball fan, and of course, we're getting ready to start a season here, so this is great that you have this program on today. Somewhat related to your focus with Italian is also, of course, baseball being the great equalizer for those of African-American descent. And I was blown over this morning before your show even came on. There was an article, still you can find it on Yahoo, on the web, where this fellow in Minnesota stumbled upon the story of a fellow by the name of John Donaldson. He was a Negro League player back before the Negro Leagues really got big. He took on in 1911 with a team called the Tennessee Rats, and they purposely took on that name because of all the derogatory comments they were taking as they would go from town to town. but it was a barnstorming team, and so the Negro Leaguers played in the smaller towns and not in the big cities. For all the crud he took, John Donaldson, according to what the statistics show, he had 350 wins, 450 strikeouts. He was guaranteed a 10 strikeout a game, every game, and was nothing for him to hit in the high 20s and even 30s if a game went in extra innings. They have a nifty quote here. He was quoted to have said that he didn't care for the personal comments. You know, he was paid to take it, and he took it in stride, just like Jackie Robinson. But he said, when they say these things, it hurts. He says, for I have no recourse. I'm getting paid, I suppose, to take that. But why should fans become personal? He says, if I act the part of a gentleman, am I not entitled to a little respect? And one other little tidbit, he was on the team, what they called the All Nations team, and they were looking for a new name, and he was the one who suggested the Monarchs, and that's where they became the Kansas City Monarchs, the most famed Negro League baseball team that ever played.
That's an interesting story. I wasn't aware of this individual. But certainly there were so many of the players that weren't able to play in the major leagues who were great, great players, and it's a shame that we don't know more about them. And you know, there is the Negro League Hall of Fame in Kansas City that I think is doing a good job in trying to generate some more knowledge about their accomplishments and what they went through.
And going back to Giamatti for just a moment, and if you want to talk more about this, early in the book, in your intro, I think, or the first chapter, you talk more about Giamatti and the metaphor of the quest for home. You go home in baseball, don't you? Mm-hmm. Fundamental to the nature of the game and to those who came from other lands in search of a new home. So it has meaning on so many levels, doesn't it?
Yeah, for him, that sense of home, when she relates to even, you know, all the heroes of Western literature from Odysseus on, left home, and the goal was to return home. So for Giamatti, the American dream is, it's a spiritual quest for home, not just a material quest. He says you always try to get back to your roots, because mm-hmm. without that, you're lost. And he says, at one point, he says, the concept of home has a particular resonance for a nation of immigrants, all of whom left one home to find another. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I talk about in the book is that this is true of these baseball players, that they grew up in these ethnic households where both parents speak Italian to the kids. Some speak back in Italian, some just speak English. But at a certain point, they make the decision that they're going to make a living playing baseball rather than staying home and doing the work like Giuseppe DiMaggio wanted his kids, stay on the fishing boat. Well, Vince, Joe, and Dom left home. They left home and they found another way to make it in America. And, you know, many of these ball players had minor success. Some of them, like Joe, of course, becomes one of the great heroes of the 20th century. But what they all had in common was this need to leave one home to find another, in the same way that their parents had left the old country to come here under very difficult circumstances to make a better living or a better life for their family. That's what these ballplayers did. Yogi Berra, in one of his autobiographies, writes very poignantly about he and his wife Carmen, who live in New Jersey and have for a long time, and thinking about his father back in St. Louis, still living in the family home after the mother has died. And there's a sense of nostalgia that Yogi relates in his book about. He knows that he's become a wealthy, famous ball player and has a lovely wife and a great home. And yet there's something about his father having those ties to the homestead. You get a sense of nostalgia and maybe a little bit of loss there because of that, leaving home to find a new home.
Mm. And we'll take more phone calls for Larry. Larry Baldassaro is our guest. We want to remind you that on Thursday of this week, today is Tuesday, he will Thursday be doing a book signing at Boswell Books. That's at 7 o'clock in the evening if you want to talk more about baseball. Larry's spent many years writing this book, and he'd love to talk to you and sign the book, too. That's on Downer Avenue here in Milwaukee. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And I just wanted to remind you that we're going to Washington. We're going to Washington tomorrow. This was a trip that came about when we went to Springfield and we pulled everybody on the bus. Where do you want to go next? And they all said, Washington, and we're going. I love the way things happen like this. Gettysburg first, and we'll be broadcasting from the NPR studios next Monday, but I'm going to be gone from this desk for a while. So John Munson will be in. He's a great host and an engaging, smart fellow. And we'll be back, you know, we'll be back eventually with lots of stories. Let's go to Mary in Stockbridge. Hi, Mary.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I love baseball, and I have a quick story about Phil Rizzuto, who I met in the late 80s, early 90s. I was managing a seafood restaurant in New Jersey, North Jersey, and Phil and his wife used to come in kind of at odd hours to have dinner. They were always kind enough to call in advance because sometimes the restaurant was, you know, just setting up, et cetera. And over the course of a couple of years, got to know him, very kind, very funny guy. And one day he said to me, Mary, are you a Yankees fan? And I said, I don't know how to answer that. And he said, well, that means you're not. Who do you root for? And I said, the Red Sox. And he kind of hung his head and he said, well, have you been to a game? And I said, no. I said, you know, I'd love to go to Fenway Park, but you can't get tickets unless you've lived there for 30 years, kind of like the Packers. And he said, let me see what I can do. So one day I got a call, and he said, listen, I'm going to be announcing Yankees Red Sox game up at Fenway. He said, I can't get you a seat, but would you mind sitting with Tom Seaver and I in the announcers.
Oh, my goodness.
And we pulled into the parking lot, and he said, now, Mary, they're not going to be nice to me. He said, close your ears. Don't pay attention to what the Red Sox fans say. And, you know, it was exactly the opposite. Everybody was, holy cow, hi, Phil.
Oh.
And he took me by the hand and introduced me to every single announcer.
Oh, Mary.
Down the row.
Great.
And, except Tom Seaver, who was a little grumpy. But it was a remarkable experience. He was a great ambassador for baseball. In my eyes, one of the kindest people I've ever met. And a few years later, we kept in contact sporadically after I left the restaurant, but a few years later, my daughter broke her leg, and what came in the mail but a giant, she was, had to stay in bed for like 12 weeks, and what came in the mail was a giant package of books, coloring books, crayons, markers. He was a wonderful guy, and I love baseball for all of the great ambassadors that it has given us.
Oh, what a great call. Isn't that a story?
Yeah, and I can certainly second their opinion of Rizzuto.
Really?
I think Phil Rizzuto and Yogi Berra, even for we Red Sox fans, are like Teflon. I mean, you can't not like them. I mean, I spent a long interview with Phil in the County Stadium press box when he was a Yankee announcer back in 93. And he was delightful.
Mm.
I mean, he was so personable and just never gave you the sense that he wanted to end the interview. I mean, he loved to talk. And at the very end of the interview, somebody comes in through the back door of the booth, and Phil turns to him and says, are those the cannoli? He loved cannoli.
Oh, great. Thank you, Mary, so much for the call. Neil in Shorewood. Hi, Neil. Probably our last call this morning. Hi, Neil.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Real well.
Good.
Real well. Question for Professor Baldessaro. Hi, Larry. This is Neil P.
Hi, Neil.
Pretty good. How are you doing?
Good.
My compliments on the book, by the way. I haven't finished reading it, but of course your listeners should know that this is actually the culmination of a lot of good work you've done on baseball and ethnicity over the years. I think the questions have been really good so far, but I have a couple of others kind of related. Number one, to Italian Americans, did it matter if a player was Neapolitan or Sicilian, or were there regional questions that come into play, or did it simply matter that he was Italian. Was that good enough? And the second part of the question, were these Italian-American ball players recognized at all in Italy itself, their achievements, or did it build any interest in this very American game?
Well, first, thanks for the kind words, Neil. It's exactly as I wrote them. I appreciate that. You know, that's interesting. You raise a really interesting question, your first one, about because they're just there's so much distinction in Italy among people from different regions. They speak different dialects, and there's, you know, some hard feelings there often because of the regional differences. And all the people that I interviewed for the book, and it's really interesting you ask this question. I never heard anyone raise that issue. Someone I interviewed in San Francisco, Dario Lodigiani, who was a neighbor of the DiMaggio's, and he talked about the DiMaggio were Sicilian, we were from Piedmont, somebody was from Tuscany. He never said there was any tension among them. And I don't think that happened in among the baseball players.
On that note, we have to say goodbye. Thank you, Larry, so much. Thanks for writing the book.
Thank you so
great.
Much.
Thanks
Pleasure.
To Chrissy Pease for producing the hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. I'm Kathleen Dunn. Be with you again in about a week.
Speaking whispers low of how they stopped our Joe.